Welcome home, class. You've come a long way.
You've come a long way.
Mine damer og herrer, konger og dronninger og alt det midt imellem. Velkommen til timen. I skal til at gøre noget, der vil forandre jeres liv for evigt.
Far off in the future. Future.
Liberty's dress and blow, blow, blow.
Tell us what you know.
Artificial cage.
Mushroom cube.
Artificial cage. Artificial cage.
Imagine me, a dog, moving in with a human. I didn't know how it would work. Turns out, my human's pretty entertaining. For instance, every time I give my human his ball, he throws it as far as he can. And I'm like, dude, that's your ball. So I go get it. But he just throws it. Again. I gotta say, though, the more he does it, the funnier it is. I love my human.
A person is the best thing to happen to a shelter pet. Be that person. Adopt. Brought to you by the Ad Council and theshelterpetproject.org.
Oh, yeah? Watch this.
Watch what?
And now, before the next show starts, let's enjoy an intermission. You'll find our snack bar chock full of good things to eat and drink. Tasty, tempting hot dogs, thirst-quenching soft drinks, fresh, crunchy popcorn, a complete assortment of delicious candy, and a full line of cigarettes. You've plenty of time, so visit the snack bar now. A tasty treat will double your enjoyment of the show. For your convenience, we shall keep you informed of the remaining intermission time, 3 minutes before the next show starts. The next show will start in 2 minutes.
Just a minute, folks. Yes, that's all it takes to visit our refreshment counter in the lobby. There you'll find popcorn and an assortment of popular candy bars to please every taste. Try one of these delicious candy bars. Big Time, Butternut, Milkshake, Payday. Topped with Hollywood's super rich coating of the kind you like best. They taste wonderful, they're delicious, they're nutritious. Get one at our confection counter in the lobby now.
The next show will start in 1 minute.
Good afternoon, Medford. You're listening to a new radio program called Watch This on 91.5 FM WMFO. My name is Chris Rowe, and thank you for listening, and thank you for watching those movies over the years. After 10 years of doing my music show, Time Travel, I was thinking, what should I do next? Should I continue on or do a new show? So I decided to do a new show. It's a movie show. I looked at all my collection of VHSs and Laserdiscs and DVDs. Didn't have any Betamax, but I had this revelation that I have just as many movies as I do CDs and tapes, and I decided why not do a new show and base it on movies. So very similar to Time Travel, it is Watch This with Chris Earle, and I have my guest today is Molly Gary.
Hi.
Hey, Molly, and Molly's got her five flicks, and here's the first one coming up. It is To Kill a Mockingbird from 1962. You're listening to Watch This here on WMFO Medford.
Ladies and gentlemen, Gregory Peck.
The world never seems as fresh and wonderful, as comforting and terrifying, as good and evil, as it does when seen through the eyes of a child. For a writer to capture that feeling is remarkable, and perhaps that is why one book in the last few years has been so warmly embraced by tens of millions of people. To Kill a Mockingbird, winner of the Pulitzer Prize and just about every other award a book can win. And now, happily, To Kill a Mockingbird becomes a motion picture, and its memorable characters come vividly alive. That Scout, some people call her Jean Louise Finch, but she insists on Scout. And that's her brother, Jim, just a boy until the day he learns there is evil in the world. And Atticus Finch, the father, whose devotion to justice places him and his children in jeopardy.
I've been appointed to defend Tom Robinson. Now that he's been charged, that's what I intend to do.
You taking his...
Excuse me, Mr. Ewell.
What kind of man are you? You got children of your own.
Atticus, Jim says his watch is going to belong to him someday.
That's right.
What are you going to give me?
There's a pearl necklace. There's a ring that belonged to your mother. You want to tell us what really happened?
I got something to say. And if you ain't gonna do nothing about it, then you're just a bunch of lousy, yellow, stinking cowards!
The first of our five flicks today, it's Molly's Five Flicks, is To Kill a Mockingbird. It's from 1962. It was unrated, 2 hours and 9 minutes. It's a drama or crime movie. It came out in March of 1963 in the USA. It was directed by a guy named Robert Mulligan. It stars Gregory Peck, John Megna, Frank Overton, and Mary Badham. And the plot is Atticus Finch, a lawyer in the Depression-era South, defends a black man against an undeserved rape charge and his children against prejudice. It was by Universal Pictures. The soundtrack's by Elmer Bernstein, which is in the background here. The budget was $2 million, and it ended up making six times that. It made $13.1 million. Has an IMDb score of 8.3 out of 10. One of the top-rated movies on IMDb at number 94. It won 3 Oscars of the 8 for which it was nominated, and Molly picked this. So tell me a little bit about why you picked this movie, To Kill a Mockingbird, Molly.
Well, when I was in the 5th grade, my teacher, Mr. Frazee, had this thing that we did on Friday afternoons after lunch called Literary Classic Theater.
Okay.
And he would pick a movie, you know, that was based on a book. And around, I think it was Black History Month, when he showed us To Kill a Mockingbird. I had read the book, and it still is my favorite book. It's hard not to fall in love with it. I mean, Gregory Peck is amazing, and the girl who plays Scout, Mary Badham, is amazing. There's nothing not to like, other than maybe the difficult subject matter.
Right. It's such an interesting movie. It's very beautiful, and it's also, there's moments that are terrifying, and there's moments that are unbelievable, like you can't believe what's actually happening. It's a level of frustration like no other at one point in the movie. Harper Lee wrote the book, and actually she did Go Set a Watchman was considered.
I read it.
The sequel to that. Did you like it?
If you like Atticus Finch, as many might not know, the character was voted number one in terms of movie heroes.
Yes,
by
it
the
was.
American Film Institute. So if you like that whole heroic image and Gregory Peck, Go Set a Watchman, Atticus is completely different. He's a racist.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, no kidding.
I mean, he's not as bad as much of a racist as Bob Yule, who's the bad guy in To Kill a Mockingbird, but he's very different.
Yeah, that's another story altogether. So why Harper Lee decided to write a sequel toward the end of her life, because she just passed away a couple of years ago. That's probably another story altogether. This to Kill a Mockingbird, though, I hadn't seen it. I think I saw clips as a kid, because I can't officially say that I had to read this in school. I don't remember actually having to read this in English class. I have read the book before, and I did like it, and I read it in college, I remember. Just kind of as something to read. It wasn't something that I needed for a class. But I hadn't seen the movie. And I could probably say I saw clips of the movie, but I don't think I officially saw the movie until 2 nights ago. And I watched it, and then I watched it immediately again. And I consider this one of the best movies I've seen in a long time.
Oh,
if not one of my favorite movies. It's got to be in the top couple of dozen movies that I got. It's just a fantastic movie. It's so well done and so well put together, and it's so ahead of its times. Atticus is a very interesting character, because he's pretty much, he's kind of a guy's guy without being a guy's guy, and he's definitely a ladies' man without being a ladies' man.
Exactly.
You know, it's there's so many things about him that are so admirable. The fact that he, first of all, he's a widower, so he has to raise the kids on his own.
Well, he is Calpurnia a little,
and
bit,
he,
ha-
and he has
part.
help, and he has help, but he basically allows them to be his equals. He treats the children like they're his equals. He realizes there's a certain age where they're going to be playful and stuff, but there's also a certain age where, you know what? Scout needs to grow up. And you get to see that over the period of time this takes place, which is about two and a half years, right? It's like at least a couple of summers and a fall. So just that character of, okay, he's a lawyer in the Deep South, and it's in the 30s, and he basically works for Chestnuts at one point, right?
Oh, that's right, because nobody could afford to pay them.
Nobody could pay him because it's right after the Great Depression. Yeah. And it's just so interesting to see how well-respected he is by not only his kids, but members of the community as well. And he takes on this case, and there's a question of, well, why did you decide to take on this case if everybody's going to be, you know, attacking us at school and people are going to attack you? And he's like, I wouldn't have been able to walk down the street anymore. You know, and he just has this integrity to him that's pretty amazing.
And one part that gets me every single time, and I've seen this movie countless times now, is at the end of the courtroom scene, you know, after Tom Robinson's been taken away and... you know, the kids had snuck in to the balcony to watch the trial. So they were sitting with all the black people in town up there.
Yeah.
And, you know, the only person left in the courtroom below is Atticus packing up, and he's about to start walking down the aisle. And one of the people says to Little Scout, he says, Miss Jean Louise, stand up. Your father's passing. Because everybody in the balcony stood up.
Yep.
When he walked out. Every time I see that, I get teary.
Yeah, and the ending as well. It's like there's a lot of moments where it's just like, you know, it was very sad, but it was also, there was a lot of hopeful things in there too. It's just kind of this roller coaster of, you know, these sweet moments, like the, you know, the tire rolling, the whole beginning with the kids, and they have Dill, the, you know, the rich kid from out of town
modeled
that's based on
Truman Capote.
Yeah, and it's neat. And then of course, you know, that little, that thing you all had, like everybody had as a kid, you know, there was always that one house you didn't want to go to that had the boogeyman in it, or some weird kid or some weird guy or whatever, which is the Boo Radley, who's played by Robert Duvall, first movie. And it's pretty neat because he doesn't talk at all.
No, I read somewhere too that he, just to get into it, in the movie's in black and white. So there's even more of a stark contrast between black and white in the movie, which makes sense. But he dyed his hair white for the movie so that it would really look like he hadn't been out of the house.
When when you finally see him, it's almost like something out of Halloween or Friday the 13th. You know, he's hiding behind a door and you see him, you're like, whoa, who's this guy, right?
Exactly.
And the thing that stops you from doing that is Scout's reaction.
Hey, Boo.
Which is like, hey, Boo. Just like, I know who this guy is, even though I've never actually officially seen him. But it's really clever how the story unfolds and how it goes back to other scenes. Like, there's this one scene that it seems just like a throwaway scene where this mad dog is going up the street. And the kids, Ed, what's the woman's name who's with Atticus that helps as the maid?
Oh, Calpurnia.
Calpurnia, okay. Yeah. So Calpurnia calls Atticus and the local sheriff to come up and take care of this mad dog who's, you know, casually wandering down the street, and they're afraid, you know, he's going to attack somebody because he has rabies. So Jem, who's the young boy, and Scout are watching as the father, Atticus, takes a pistol and takes care of the mad dog and takes aim at the mad dog. And you get to see a moment where they never thought they would actually see their father do something like this. But it's also well known by the members of the adult community in town that he's the best shot in town, and they never knew this.
Because he always told them it was a sin to kill a mockingbird. And so I never, you know, I don't think they ever thought they would see any sort of violence or anything like that from Atticus.
Right. Yeah, it's really clever the way that they put a lot of stuff together. Just going back to the beginnings with Boo and the trinkets that he leaves for him, and how it comes around toward the end. It's really, really, really well done script. And there's a point in there too where the town is small, so it was obviously filmed like on a set. You know, I'm assuming most of it was filmed on a set.
I think it's the back lot of Universal, told me, yeah.
Okay. And there's a moment where, you know, when you're in the beginning, you're in It's Alabama, right?
Mm-hmm. Macomb, Alabama.
Macomb, Alabama, and Macomb was like a fake name for the town.
I think the real town was Monroeville, I believe, where she grew up. Yeah.
And you could tell it's hot. You could feel the sun. You could feel like there. You see Scout, and she's in the overalls, and they're all filthy, just running around. And then later on, when the summers have passed, and then it's Halloween, and they have their long night together, walking back from the Halloween party. Where Scout's dressed up as a ham, you feel that coldness,
right.
and they did it such a well. They did such a great job with just the lighting and you know just making it cold and dangerous. And I love the fact that even though it's violent, they don't show the violence. It's more terror than violence.
I think one part when I first saw it in the fifth grade, Well, that whole scene is scary, but the part that really freaked me out was when you see his hand.
Right.
Because, you know, Scout is in the ham, literally.
Yeah.
She's in her ham.
She's wearing a canned ham.
And it kind of saved her life, really, you know, that she had this costume on. And when you see the two hands, I don't want to ruin it, but, you know, when you see there's two hands and you know who one of them is, but who's...
You're not sure who's coming to save the day,
and you know the other hand is not Jem,
right.
Because it's an adult hand.
Right.
So it freaks you out, but you also wonder, like, who is that?
Well, it's interesting, too, because, I mean, you could equate... There's so many different ways to read this film if you want to deep dive into it. I mean, the ham, just like wearing that costume, to me, is like, that's her knight's armor. You know, it's like, that's her growing up. You know, it's her on her first quest, and it's her on her first battle, you know, in adulthood, because you get to see her go from this young girl to somebody who's very precocious little lady at the end of it. You know, it's really, really, really very clever.
And that girl got nominated for an Oscar, and I think she was only like 10.
That's correct. Yeah.
So
yeah.
I think until Tatum O'Neill got nominated, she was the youngest person ever to be nominated. She might still be. I don't know.
Yeah, she's excellent.
She didn't win, but
yeah.
Gregory Peck did win.
Gregory Peck won, that's right.
It was his only Oscar, only unless he got, like, if he ever got a lifetime achievement or something. But he always said that Atticus was his favorite role.
Yes, that's what I heard, too. And Elmer Bernstein, who did the soundtrack is amazing here.
I love it.
It's... let me see what I got here on that. Elmer Bernstein's score for To Kill a Mockingbird, regarded as one of the greatest film scores, and it was actually recorded over again 3 times. So he actually went out and he got more orchestras to record it over again because it was so popular for people, they kept releasing it. It was first released in April of 1963, and then Elmer Bernstein re-recorded it in the 70s for his own film music collection series, and finally he recorded the complete score in 1996 with the Royal Scottish National Orchestra for the Varese Scaraband Film Classic series. He also did a number of other movies, including, I believe, Animal House, which we had one of them a couple of weeks ago. Yeah, somebody picked Animal House in their top 5. Matter of fact, I think it was me when I did the show on my own.
One thing I found out with the score, you know, in the very beginning of the movie, it's very innocent.
Yes.
You know, in the opening credits, it's very childlike, which I think is the point.
Yep.
And it's a lone piano at the beginning.
Right.
And I found out that's John Williams.
No
playing
kidding.
The piano.
Wow, no kidding.
Yeah. And I was like, okay, John Williams is involved. Shocker.
Oh, that's great.
Because it was done at Universal, and John Williams was a Universal guy for the most part.
Sure,
yeah.
So if you were a session musician at Universal, you pretty much jumped on set to set and did score to score. That's pretty cool. So Elmer Bernstein, a couple of other movies that he did, Ten Commandments, which is one of the ones that Winston picked on his five
great
flicks.
Movie.
Great Escape, another great movie, Magnificent Seven, Animal House, Cape Fear, Airplane, Age of Innocence, and also Ghostbusters. He did the background scenes, the background music for Ghostbusters. So, he passed away in 2004 at the age of 82, but Elmer Bernstein did quite a few great, great film scores, including this one. We mentioned Atticus Finch is the number one hero. I really love that scene, too, where he goes to talk to Tom Robinson's family, and what's it, Mr. Yule?
Bob Yule.
Bob Yule comes out, and he just tries to pick a fight with him, and and Atticus won't have it.
He just looks at him and doesn't blink.
Yeah, for a moment there, you think maybe, and then that's the scene, too, where you know if you were with a whole bunch of people in the theater, especially nowadays, or you're in a classroom watching this with your friends, they're like, man, do something, do something. And that's what's brilliant about this character, because he's always so much better than everyone else, but he's humble.
Mm-hmm.
That's the thing. He's humble, and he also doesn't think he's better than everybody else. He just tries to do the right thing the whole time. And it's a great, great movie. And the very end of it, too, where, you know, he's sitting there and he's waiting and he's with the kids. It just kind of, it's a great summing up of the story, you know. And you have this narrator who's the narrator is basically Scout is a grown-up.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And you never get to see her, but she's this voice of reason that tells you the story. And it works, you know. You have this little slice of her life. And it basically tells you a lot about, you know, what happened growing up. And it gives you that picture of what it was like in the Deep South with racism, too. It's really, really clever. It's really well done. And it's on Netflix.
Is it really?
Yeah, it's on Netflix.
I own it, so.
Yeah, it's on Netflix. So anybody who wants to see it, check it out on Netflix. In 2005, British Film Institute included it in their list of 50 films you should see by the age of 14. Which
14? I was 11, so
yeah.
I made it.
I think that's great. I don't think you should show it to a six-year-old, you know. But if you have a kid, I'd say, yeah.
I'd say 10 or
11. 10 or 11 years old. Show them this movie.
Mm-hmm. 'Cause it's important.
It's a really important movie. It's mm-hmm. really, it's really good. It's good. It has good values, you know. It's an awesome movie. Gregory Peck's 9-minute summation speech was done in just one take.
That's nuts.
Isn't that great?
I mean, that's clearly the part that won him his Oscar.
Yeah, absolutely.
The whole courtroom scene. It's amazing.
Just so well done. And the whole courtroom scene, it's heartbreaking what happens.
Yeah, it's
fantastic. And they've also rated that as like the number one courtroom scene in like a bunch of not law journals, but like law, you know, law websites.
One thing I learned too was Brock Peters, who played Tom Robinson.
Yes.
Well, one side note, he and Gregory Peck ended up becoming really great friends.
Mm-hmm.
He did the eulogy
at
Gregory Peck's funeral.
Uh-huh.
If you can imagine that powerful voice doing something like that. But also, when Tom Robinson is on the stand and Atticus is questioning him, Brock Peters really started crying and had tears going down his face, and Gregory Peck apparently couldn't look at him, because if he looked at him, then he would have started crying, so he had to pick a spot on the wall behind him and look at it so that he wasn't looking Brock Peters in the eye.
He's fantastic in the movie, too. He's fantastic. The Gregory Peck, just fantastic. This is definitely his movie, like all the stuff that he did, and he did some great, great movies. You know, he's top notch in this. After being offered the role, he quickly read the novel in one sitting and called the director, Robert Mulligan, and said that he would gladly play Atticus Finch. Again, great, great, great flick. And one of the reasons why, you know, I did this show, I was happy because, you know, I have my friends come in and you pick movies that I wouldn't normally think of, and I'm either re-looking at them in a new way, or I'm actually discovering them for the first time. And in this particular case, like I said, I don't really know whether I saw this or not. I'm guessing I didn't, or I was so young, I just don't remember. You know, I don't remember having to read this in English class. I remember reading it in college, but I don't think I ever saw the movie. And other than like clips in film classes, but I was so glad that you picked this one and brought this one into my life here. And it's a great, great flick. So we can move on to the next movie if you want and listen to a little bit more of the soundtrack of To Kill a Mockingbird, unless you have a couple other things you want to say, Molly?
One thing, another fun thing. I found out a lot of fun trivia things for this particular movie that I had no clue about. And another one was Harper Lee, who in the years following the book coming out and then the movie a few years after that, she became a recluse. Like, nobody really saw her.
Yeah.
You know, she almost like a Boo Radley kind of. Well, she was out and about in town, but she didn't like the fame at all.
Yeah.
So when the movie was being filmed, this was before the reclusive period, she was on set quite a lot because she also had a percentage. She made a percentage of the gross. And she and Gregory Peck got very close. And She was so she loved how Gregory Peck, how he used the watch to show Scout the watch, and then he also fiddles with it a lot in the courtroom scenes, and she reminded him so much of her father that she gave him her dad's real pocket watch
as
a gift after the movie. So the watch you see in the movie was not, you know, it wasn't like a real watch or whatever. But then years later, Gregory Peck's only daughter, his youngest child, named her son Harper Lee after her.
That's
which
nice.
Is kind of sweet. Yeah.
Yeah. So it did win 3 Academy Awards of the 8, which was nominated Academy Award Best Actor for Gregory Peck, Best Adapted Screenplay for Horton Foote, and Academy Award for Best Art Direction, Set Direction, Black and White. It was nominated for Picture, Director, Cinematography, Actress in a Supporting Role, and Best Musical Score. But its competition that year was Lawrence of Arabia, which ended up winning.
Had no chance against that, unfortunately.
Winning all of those. Yeah. Well, I think this is a better movie than Lawrence of Arabia.
I agree.
By far, and I think it's much more important than Lawrence of Arabia.
Definitely.
Lawrence of Arabia, to me, was a spectacle. It was, you know...
It's a great epic.
It's a great epic, but... Yeah. At the same time, when it comes down to it, doesn't say a whole lot like
exactly.
This movie does. But, yeah, it's a great, great one. I'm going to leave you with a little bit more of the soundtrack of To Kill a Mockingbird, and then we will move on to the next flick. It's The Sound of Music from 1965.
My favorite movie.
You're listening to Watch This with myself and Molly Gary. We are here with you until 7 p.m.
Maria, how do you catch a cloud and pin it down?
How do you find a word that means Maria?
A flippity gibbet, a will-o'-the-wisp,
a clown.
I am 16, going on 17. I know that I'm naive.
Girls in white
dresses with blue satin sashes, snowflakes that stay on my nose and eyelashes, silver white winters that melt into springs. These are a few of my favorite things.
So, a needle pulling thread, la, a note to follow, so, tea, a drink with jam and bread.
Good place to start. When you read, you begin with
A, B, C.
When you sing, you begin with Do, Re, Mi.
Do, Re, Mi.
Do, Re, Mi. The first three notes just happen to be Do, Re, Mi.
Do, Re, Mi.
Do, Re, Mi, Fa, Sol, La, Ti. Oh, let's see if I can make it easier. Doe, a deer, a female deer. Ray, a drop of golden sun. Me, a name I call myself. Far, a long, long way to run. So, a needle pulling thread. La, a note to follow so. Tea, a drink with jam and bread. That will bring us back to Do, oh, oh, oh.
Do!
A deer, a female deer.
Ray!
A drop of golden sun.
Me!
A name I call myself.
Ba!
A long, long way to run.
So!
A needle pulling thread. La! A note to follow so.
Do, re, mi, fa, so, and so on are only the tools we use to build a song. Once you have these notes in your heads, you can sing a million different tunes by mixing them up, like this.
So, do, la, fa, mi, do, re.
Can you do that?
So, do, la, fa, mi, do, re.
So, do, la, ti, do.
It all together.
So do la fa mi do re. So do la ti do re do.
Good,
but it doesn't mean anything.
So we put in words, one word for every note, like this.
When you know the notes to sing, you can sing most anything
together.
When you know the notes to sing, you can sing most anything.
Do,
a deer, a female deer, red, a drop of golden sun,
a name.
I could never get that high.
I could. Years ago, I could, but not now. She had like a 5-octave range back in the day, which is nuts.
Crazy.
Yeah.
The Sound of Music, 1965. It's rated G. It's a family movie. Even though it has Nazis, it's a family movie. 2 hours and 52 minutes. It's a drama. It's a musical. Family movie. It's also a biography about the Von Trapps. Came out March 29th, 1965. Directed by a guy named Robert Wise, who directed a lot of great, great movies from Hollywood.
Mm-hmm.
Stars Julie Andrews, Christopher Plummer, the seven kids. the plot is a woman leaves an Austrian convent to become a governess to the children of a naval officer widower. So another widower in this one. We had Atticus
mm-hmm,
Finch.
That's right.
And now we have Christopher Plummer. Studio 20th Century Fox. Soundtrack to The Sound of Music was written by Rodgers and Hammerstein and arranged and conducted by Erwin Kostal, who adapted the instrumental underscore passages. The soundtrack album was released by RCA Victor in 1965 and is one of the most successful soundtrack albums in history, sold over 20 million copies worldwide. It had a budget of $8.2 million, which is a pretty decent budget, and it made $286.2 million, which is like $1 billion now.
That's insane, yeah. Until Jaws actually surpassed it 10 years later, it was the highest grossing film ever.
No kidding, wow. Uh-huh. And it has an 8.0 out of 10 on IMDb, so it's got a pretty high score there on IMDb. As you know, for the listeners, like, I like to do the IMDb score versus the Rotten Tomatoes scores. Mm-hmm. I like the IMDb scores a little bit more. So, Molly, tell me about your history with The Sound of Music.
Well, I was just telling you, I learned some of the songs before I ever saw the movie. So the song that you can hear now,
uh-huh,
my favorite things I learned in kindergarten. And then Do Re Mi, I think I learned in preschool or something.
Sure.
So I was familiar with a lot of the music, and I had seen the opening,
yep,
part of the movie, which is, in my opinion, the best opening scene of any movie.
Yeah.
I didn't see it till I was 15.
No kidding. All right.
When my parents owned a Cape House back then, and my sister and I, you know, were at the library. We wanted to rent a movie, and my sister said, oh, we should see The Sound of Music. It's really good. I said, yeah, I've never seen it. And she couldn't mm-hmm. believe that. So we went home that night and watched it, and ever since I've been hooked. It's my favorite. I watch it all the time.
This is my mom's favorite movie. I believe it's still my mom's favorite movie, but yeah, she loved this movie. I remember mm-hmm. I remember listening to Do Re Mi in music class.
Yep.
And I want to say, you know, kindergarten, first grade, fifth mm-hmm. grade, like all of those had something from The Sound of Music.
It's a good way to
Do
teach
Re
kids
Mi.
Music. It
absolutely
really is.
And My Favorite Things was actually one of the first parodies I did for stand-up. I did
nice.
Unpleasant Things is what it was called. And it was just, you know, wasn't as raunchy as my later parodies were, but it was it had a lot of unpleasant things in it. But yeah, this is a great movie. It has Julie Andrews in it, who's got an amazing voice, probably one of the best voices of all time, in my opinion. It's
I
a very
agree.
pleasant voice. And I actually love Mary Poppins too, which came out as they were filming this.
That.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
she won an Oscar for Mary Poppins, which also made this one. This was like her real highlighted period of her life.
Oh,
right,
definitely.
Here it was Sound of Music,
yeah,
and Mary Poppins back to back. And how she is with the kids is just awesome in this. It's just really, really, really fun. And there's also moments of seriousness in this that are like, whoa, what's going on here? You know, when like the Nazis come in and stuff. But it's very, very well done. And the music, and it's fantastic, and that's why it sold 20 million albums. So one of the pieces that I got for trivia, Julie Andrews sang the Supercalifragilisticexpialidocious song to the children in the mm-hmm. cast to entertain them in between shooting. And Mary Poppins hadn't been out yet, so the kids thought she actually just made it up as she went along.
And she told them how to... I watched a commentary because it's kind of sad, but...
yes.
Or my mother thinks it's sad, but I have 3 different copies of The Sound of Music, and each one's a little different because of the commentary and
really?
Whatever. Oh, yeah, I have 3, you know, I have the 50th anniversary, I have the 40th, it's ridiculous, but
yep.
on one of them, the 7 kids, who obviously aren't kids anymore, they had done like a reunion for the 40th anniversary, which would have been 2005.
Right.
And they talked about that, how she would sing to them the supercalifragilistic in between takes to get them, because they, when they do My Favorite Things, that was shot at the beginning of the movie.
Uh-huh.
So to get them kind of enjoying themselves and into it, she sang that. And she also taught them how to say it backwards. So
yes.
That they could, I think it was Docia Sally Expiastic Fragile Calirrhupus.
Calirrhupus, yes. Rupus.
Yep.
Yeah, that's pretty good. Yeah, there's all kinds of other trivia I found on this and fun. I like to go to the Wikipedia and the IMDb and find stuff.
That's exactly what I did, too.
But also, I rewatched a number of scenes here. I didn't rewatch this whole movie. I would consider this an epic as well.
Oh,
would
yeah.
you consider this an epic?
Not only with the subject and everything, but the length.
It's 2 hours and 52 minutes.
Movie, yeah.
And I think this one may have a... doesn't this one have a break, an intermission in the middle
does.
Of it?
It does.
Yeah.
And, it does.
And in
yeah.
the old days, they would do what was called like a road show for a movie.
Mm-hmm.
And it was like an event. So you would go out and it was a movie theater, but it would be like in an actual theater. And then you'd have your intermission where they would actually play music. And a lot of it was music that was made specifically for the movie's intermission. And people would go out and say how they were liking the movie, whatever, and then go back in. But, so this one had what was called an intermission when they did the road shows for The Sound of Music. So a lot of times, like, you would see those on the VCR mm-hmm. releases, the special releases of the DVDs, the laser discs. I actually saw this when I was out the other day, 99 cents on the VHS, and I'm like, I just want another copy on VHS just to have
there you
it.
Go.
You know? But here's a couple other things I found for trivia here. When Maria's running through the courtyard to the Von Trapp house in the song I Have Confidence, she trips and falls. She trips, and it was an accident, but the director Robert Wise liked it so much he kept it in the movie. And he thought the nervousness of the song and of the character went well together.
She had a vaudeville background, too, so it made sense.
Mm-hmm. After the Von Trapps fled Austria, their home was taken over by Himmler, who was one of the key players of the Nazi Party, and Hitler personally visited Himmler there at the Von Trapp home several times. Christopher Plummer intensely disliked working on this film. He's
yes,
been known
he did.
To refer to it as the sound of mucus, or S&M, and likened working with Julie Andrews to being hit over the head with a big Valentine's Day card
yeah.
every single day. Nonetheless, he and Julie Andrews remained close friends ever since. Now, in the reunion show I saw one with him, and I saw one without him.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I think what was the Oprah one? The Oprah one had him, right?
Oprah one had him, and I remember it was a big deal because that was the first time they had all been together since the movie.
Yeah. So I think that was a little later than the mm-hmm. other one that I saw, which was her and the seven kids, and I think it was like the Today Show or something like that, because mm-hmm. I know they do reunions like that sometimes. I was surprised how some of these reunions are just so unscripted, so everybody's like, the two hosts are talking over, like one of them was Diane Sawyer, I think.
Oh,
and,
really?
And she's talking over Julie Andrews, not really allowing her to speak. And I'm just like, geez, let her speak. It's like, what'd you invite her for if you
exactly.
just got to talk about, you know, what you thought of the movie? But, yeah, it was pretty neat, like, all the stuff that you get to find on these films over the years. Because it's so well-loved. There's so much information on them, which is what I like. You know,
there's
so much more extra history on it.
Christopher Plummer, I'm 35.
Mm-hmm.
And Christopher Plummer was my age. When he did Captain Von Trapp. When
Isn't
he
that
played,
funny?
And he, the real Captain Von Trapp, because I've read the book that all of this is based on, the story of the Trapp family singers.
Mm-hmm.
And the real Captain was late 40s when and Maria was 22. So they were 25 years apart in reality.
Mm.
So in order for Christopher Plummer to look a little more, to look a little older, you know, they added gray to his hair and
yeah.
all of that. But yeah, he was young. He was only 30. And Julie Andrews was in her late 20s.
No kidding.
Mm-hmm. And the girl that played Liesel was 21.
Right. And she's supposed to be 16 or 17, uh-huh. right? 16 going on 17. Is she the one that does that song?
Yep.
I love the gold suit that Christopher Plummer has, too. Doesn't he have like a gold... He has like a gold suit, or he's wearing like an overcoat or something that's like a gold or yellow or something
oh,
like that.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Because at one point, all the kids are dressed up in yellow dresses.
Oh,
and they're all singing.
The curtains.
The curtains, right.
Yeah.
There was very little background on information on the real Captain Von Trapp. he was that was known or available to Christopher Plummer. So the actor took to the Salzburg Mountains with an interpreter, and there he met George's nephew and asked him what the real Captain Von Trapp was like. And the nephew told Christopher Plummer he was the most boring man he had ever met.
Yeah, I think that's why. One of the things I saw with Christopher Plummer once, he was really the one responsible for making Captain Von Trapp the way he is in the movie.
Yeah.
He and the scriptwriter, Ernest Lehman, I believe, they literally sat in a room together for 2 days and fleshed out the character, because Christopher Plummer thought he was so boring and flat. You would think a naval captain decorated by the Emperor of Austria would be interesting, but apparently not.
Yeah. I think my first foray into The Sound of Music, I'm looking at some more information here on the Wikipedia. The first American television transmission of The Sound of Music was on February 29th, 1976 on ABC. They paid $15 million for a one-time-only broadcast that became one of the top-rated films ever shown on network television to that point. I would say I watched it that night, because I remember watching it as a kid, and I remember vividly with my mom and my dad, who were, you know, both married at the time. They got divorced when I was, I think, 6 or 7. So we were together in Bedford, and we used to watch The Wonderful World of Disney, which believe was every Sunday.
I remember that.
Mm-hmm. And I remember I thought The Sound of Music was Disney. And I remember sitting down and us watching. I was really young. I mean, I was only 5 at that point. But I remember seeing this on TV. And then years later, when it came out on VHS, I remember my mom buying The Sound of Music on VHS. And she said that was one of her favorite movies, if not her favorite movie.
Definitely, yeah.
So there's another thing that I have here. It's a fun piece of trivia. When Maria and the captain are at the gazebo to kiss the first time, Julie Andrews couldn't help laughing because a lighting device was making a raspberry every time she leaned in to kiss Christopher Plummer. After more than 20 takes, the scene was altered to silhouette the two and to hide Andrews' giggles. So every time she leaned in to kiss him, she started laughing.
Yeah, that doesn't surprise me too much. But actually, when I just watched it recently for this, I noticed how when they are in silhouette,
yes,
the way the light is, it looks like there's a heart between the two.
That's right. Yeah, I remember that too.
Yeah. So yep. It worked better, I think, you know, the way that they did it.
What's your favorite song on it?
My favorite? Well, I don't know. It's a toss-up. Actually, probably Edelweiss.
Yeah, I think that Julie Andrews said that was her favorite,
yeah,
I think.
Yeah, I recently, the reason I couldn't do the show with you a few weeks ago was because I went to see The Sound of Music in Boston.
Nice.
And I had seen it on stage in New York years ago, almost 20 years ago, but the movie's better, I'll tell you right now.
Yeah.
The movie's better than the stage show, but I had seen, you know, both though before I saw this, and I'm in the lobby at intermission, and there's this one guy that was freaking out. He's like, oh my God, they skipped over Edelweiss. How could they do that? How could they do that? And he was, you know, fanning himself, freaking out. And I remember thinking, just wait.
Wasn't over yet.
Because in the stage show,
yep,
they only do Edelweiss during the concert at the end.
Oh, okay.
So that scene with the captain singing Edelweiss, it was added for the movie. And actually,
so he was getting a little ahead of himself.
Right.
He's getting all worked up over nothing.
Edelweiss was actually, Oscar Hammerstein was dying of cancer when The Sound of Music was doing its out-of-town tryout before Broadway in Boston, actually. So he came up here, though, to see them.
Huh.
And he wrote Edelweiss in Boston.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. It's a beautiful song, but my favorite things I love, too.
Mm-hmm. So this one you can find, again, on VHS, Laserdisc, DVD, Blu-ray. There was a 35th anniversary of the film's release, the first DVD version. Then there was a 40th anniversary DVD with documentaries and special features. Then there was a debut on Blu-ray where it's 45th anniversary in 2010. And they had the original 70mm negative rescanned at 8K resolution, restored and remastered to a 4K resolution for a transfer of the Blu-ray, giving the most detailed copy of the film ever seen.
Good.
So you must like watch that Blu-ray on a nice TV and just
oh,
be
yeah.
like, oh my God,
it's
I'm
awesome.
There.
Yeah. The quality is really, really good.
Yeah. On March 10th, 2015, Fox Home Entertainment released The Sound of Music 50th Anniversary.
I have that too.
Ultimate Edition. 5 discs with 13 yep. hours of bonus features.
It's awesome.
Including a documentary called The Sound of a City, Julie Andrews Returns to Salzburg.
It's nice. I liked it. It's like an hour long.
And then it says there's also the episode of 2020 entitled Untold Stories, Sound of Music, with a preview of the documentary interviews with Diane Sawyer. So that must have been some of the ones that I just saw recently, too. So, yeah, it's pretty cool. So basically 35th, 40th, 45th, 50th. They'll probably do a 55th anniversary,
probably.
Maybe a 60th. but, yeah, great movie. Good pick. What else you have to say about Sound of Music? Otherwise, we will move on to our third flick.
I don't know. It's just a movie that means a lot to me. You know, I don't...
And one of the best musicals of all time.
Oh, hands down.
Yeah.
I think it's one of the cheesiest. Like, won't...
But it's a kid's movie. What's nice is you can all watch it together.
Yeah. But the Nazi part of it, I think, it brings down the cheese level a little.
It's not as heavy as To Kill a Mockingbird, that's for sure.
No.
But it's very fun. You could say it's fun.
And I've been to Salzburg where a lot of this movie was filmed, and I've seen a lot of the sites, and it's really cool. People in the tourists flock to Salzburg.
Mm-hmm.
And they go on the Sound of Music tour, and they get to see the houses. There's two different houses that stood in for the Trap Villa.
Nice.
They couldn't film the movie at the original Trap Villa because when Himmler lived there, they built a brick wall around the property.
Really?
So it wouldn't have worked.
Nah.
But one thing they taught
me... Too enclosed, yeah.
When I was on the tour was, you know how at the end of the movie when they're going over the mountains to Switzerland?
Uh-huh.
Our guide was like, no, if you went over these mountains, and he pointed to them, to the Alps, he's like, you would go into Germany, and you would be very close to Hitler's mountain retreat.
No kidding.
So that they're not going over the mountains into Switzerland.
It's The Sound of Music. It's from 1965. My name is Chris Earle. I'm here with Wally Gary, and we are doing Molly's Five Flicks today on Watch This with Chris Earle, here with you until 7 p.m. Be back in a moment with flick number 3.
Someday a friend may offer you a chance to visit the other side of a dream. Your ticket is a little packet of white powder called heroin. But every packet of heroin is different. You don't know what's getting into you. Some doses are so strong they kill. Heroin is so vicious that the criminals who make the big money in heroin don't use it. They know a lot of reasons why heroin is very, very dumb. Maybe that's why they call it dope.
91.5 WMFO Medford.